Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for September 15th, 2013. I'm your host, David McLaughlin, and joining me as always, welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
And welcome Catherine Smith.
Hello, everyone.
Yes. Well, Catherine, I was down your way in Atlanta today for the Falcons game. I went the other direction to park near Georgia State. I saw that they were installing the trolley line. I didn't know they were even anywhere that close to getting that thing going, but they have started putting a lot of that in. I saw the work, and I saw the new canary they installed near Five Points. I had a live canary in a cage hanging on a pole outside the Five Point stations as I walked in. It was gone by the time I walked out, so I don't know what's going on there.
I don't know anything about a canary.
Yeah,
but yes,
I had a live canary in a cage.
But yes, the trolley is definitely underway and causing a lot of traffic and construction delays when trying to get through parts of town. But I'm not complaining. It's just
yeah. Well, we'll have to. Yeah.
We all have to think about that whenever we want to go to the, you know, Curb Market or go out to Cab Avenue or anything like that. So it's just an important thing to remember.
Yeah, discuss that more as it comes closer. Of course, the main thing is it looks like they're going to have to get people to stop parking on one of those lanes on Edgewood Avenue because the trolley seems to be share the only eastbound lane on Edgewood Avenue. So if they don't get the cars off there that are parked in front of the subway and whatnot, restaurant and whatnot, a lot of problems. Well, let's get into other topics. And first off, I want to say in about 15 minutes, our guest, Charlie Harper of Peach Pundit, will join us. Probably talk a lot of Georgia politics, maybe a few Republican poll issue things possibly, but more on Georgia. But until then, let's go a little national. We don't do this a lot. And let's start off by talking about Syria. And the president gave a live speech on Syria. And then there's some polling that's come out that shows that the idea is not real popular. And, of course, other folks have made it to political football. I'm going to give my take on how people feel about the Middle East first and the president. And then I'm going to go, Charlie, have y'all say. I think there's a lot of people in the polling showing this, left, right, and center, that just, of course, have, you know, Middle East war fatigue. I mean, these are people that, you know, just are, you know, we went to Iraq, we went to Afghanistan, you know, there's rumors of getting involved in Iran. And people are just kind of having, I guess what you might call it, you know, Middle East war fatigue. And they hear Syria and they think, man, another country with a lot of sand, with a lot of political problems. And that's causing problems there. Then you got a lot of folks that are more Republican-leaning that honestly, if President Obama were to come on the other night and said, we have found the opening to the gates of hell, and we know we can take out Satan with one airstrike with no casualties, who's for it? They'd be against it because he was for it. And that's just, to me, seems like where between those two things, you know, the Syria airstrike possibility is just not very popular. But then, of course, a lot of times with foreign policy, you can't necessarily decide on what's popular. Tim, what's your take on this thing?
Well, yeah, you're right about that, David. Back in the 50s when Lyndon Johnson was the majority leader, he described what he and the Democrats were doing, as being part of the loyal opposition. I don't think anything like that exists now. And I think that there are a significant group of voters, I'd say over 40% of the Republican base for certain, would be opposed to any decision that he made on any issue. So I don't think there's any reason to worry about it. Now, this thing with Russia has made it interesting. If this works, the president's going to come out of this looking really good. He will have avoided any military action, and the chemical weapons will be gone. Now, if that happens, what will his detractors who oppose every move he makes have to say then? I don't know what they'll say. I'm sure they'll come up with something to say, like he was, you know, Putin's little doggy or something. I don't know. But they'll come up with something, but they're really going to have a hard time making anything stick if this works.
Yeah, well, of course, he could send Dana Rockbacker over there to have an arm wrestling rematch, but apparently the first one already happened. Catherine, what's kind of your take on the Syria situation and how people feel about it?
Well, I think I tend to agree with what you're both saying, that, you know, the Republicans are going to be against anything that the president puts forward. But I do think that it's been kind of fascinating to watch the sort of old guard military, military supporting Republicans be almost like peace freaks. I just think it's always an interesting, you know, it seems like, because the president was, you know, putting forward this idea of, you know, whatever he called them, pinprick strikes. But I have to tell you, you know, I'm always happy when we aren't killing people. It always makes me happy when we're not killing people. Like, and so I'm very happy that we seem to have been able to find a way to not put our young men and women in harm's way and not, you know, kill anyone else from any other country. I do think that I saw a headline today that the Syrians are all, like, you know, happy about this and they think they've gotten one over on the president. So I think that if everyone feels like they've gotten something, then that's a win. And if we aren't at war, then I think that's a huge win. If Putin feels like he, you know, somehow, like, you know, Obama's his lapdog, which I don't think anybody is really ever going to think that. And if the president feels like he was able to negotiate this, or, you know, or Secretary of State Kerry or whoever, if we as Americans feel like we were able to negotiate through this, and Syria feels like they, I think that is the best we can hope for in diplomacy, right? That everyone feels like they got what they wanted. And so I think that, you know, if we end up there, then the president has done a really amazing job and something that we haven't, an accomplishment that we haven't seen in many, many years. So I think this has the potential to be very good for the president if it actually all manifests as it seems to be.
Yeah, I think, you know, just looking at the political side of it, because that's what we do a lot of times, the president's popularity's taken a hit. Now, that may just be a lot of fatigue, just the fact that he's, you know, nearly 6 years in to his term. But then as far as Syria goes, you know, there's just some people that just, they're just tired of war. I mean, left, right, and center. I mean, and so it's hard sometimes, at least the folks on the right, to divide out those folks who are like, man, just not another war, between those that are just like, hey, if it was Republican, we'd be all for it, but since it's a Democrat, we're all against it. And sometimes it's hard to delineate those people from one from another. Don't you think, Tim?
Oh, yeah. I want to clarify something, too. I'm opposed to any military strike over there. Especially a rather limited one. I don't know what it's going to do if it leaves Assad in power. And I just think it's something we cannot do. I just keep thinking about what Herman Talmadge said over 40 years ago when he said that we cannot be banker, Santa Claus, and policeman for the world. You know, it would be just really great if we could do that, but we're going to go bankrupt doing that. And, you know, this nation-building stuff, we shouldn't do it. Just as I was opposed to the war in Iraq. If the Russian initiative works, that I'm all for it. Let's give that a shot and see what happens, because I just don't see what a limited military strike is going to accomplish.
And just I want to mention something that's unrelated but speaks to this. So, you know, last week the First Lady is doing this, you know, drink more water campaign. It's been on all the TV shows, David Letterman, Today Show, the Good Morning America. So the Republicans are criticizing her. She's recommending. She's just like reminding people that we should all be drinking more water, that water is good for us, and that we should drink more water. But the Republicans are coming out and saying, well, there's really no evidence of that. So no matter what they do, they're going to be criticized. So no matter what the president does, they're not going to like it. I just think it's hilarious that you can't even recommend that people drink more water without being criticized.
Well, that's like, you know, that would be like Democrats that were against childhood literacy because Barbara Bush was for it. I mean, that's just silly. I mean, a lot of times, you know, most first ladies choose topics that are not, you know, super divisive. And I think drinking more water would probably fall into that. I mean, but then I guess a lot of folks are just, you know, I've been criticized for wanting folks to eat more vegetables and planting a vegetable garden. And then, of course, I got wrapped up in that whole thing about Twinkies and whatnot. And it's just kind of crazy how people want to politicize the First Lady's office at times when that office is not being trying to be politicized. I think that's why I think one thing will be fascinating about Hillary Clinton's presidency is that Bill Clinton, of course, will be, you know, the first man. And what exactly will he tackle? And the fact that he's been president, will he look at, you know, maybe softer issues, if you will?
He'll try to make us all vegan, like him.
Maybe so. But, you know, I get the idea that the president, you know, President Clinton, when he decided to go vegan, was more of a, hey, my heart was kind of bad. I'm just trying to be, you know, healthier. I don't know that he was trying to, you know, push his personal lifestyle on anybody anyway.
I know. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
But
yeah, so it'd be interesting to see how this plays out. Of course, the biggest thing with any speech, be it Democrat or Republican, unfortunately for a lot of Americans, is the fact that it pushes the TV schedules off track, no matter how important whatever they're talking about is. People get all ill about that.
Well, you know, there's always going to be the crowd of mental giants that are mad because the president is preempting Honey Boo Boo or something, right?
You know, well, at least Honey Boo Boo is unable, so that doesn't get preempted.
Honey Boo Boo starts
being
on TV.
But you know what I'm saying. I'm saying. It's the same type of shows to me, you know, that reality.
Oh, yeah, it was like Dancing with the Stars or whatever.
Yeah, Honey Boo Boo or Sean Hannity's show. Oh, wait, Honey Boo Boo has a deeper thought. Anyway, that's scary. I tell you what, we hadn't talked much about Honey Boo Boo, but I've actually watched an episode since the last time we talked about it. And sometimes I'm ashamed to say we're both from Georgia. I don't know about y'all.
I'm more ashamed to say that Sean Hannity was here than I am that Honey Boo Boo's here.
Yeah, those folks are getting $40,000 an episode to be on that show, David. You're not getting paid anything to watch it. Now, I want you to consider that for just a moment and consider it deeply, okay, buddy?
And I don't know what. Yeah, and I don't know what they're spending their $40,000 on either. I'm kind of lost on that one.
ain't touching that one.
Yeah, me either.
Yeah, I mean, I start showing on the show. Well, let's get this discussion a little more highbrow. We want to welcome back to the show for just a repeated favorite guest of ours on the Kudzu Vine from Peach Pundit. Welcome, Charlie Harper.
Well, it's good to be with you. I had to interrupt watching Honey Boo Boo to take the show. But...
Yeah, you know it's bad when we're going highbrow with Charlie Harper.
Touché.
Don't ask me how we got from Syria to Honey Boo Boo as a segue to bring you in, but we did anyway. So
the trend line is obvious.
Yeah. Well, Charlie, when we have you on, we love to have you as like the Georgia Republican expert. While Catherine, Tim, and I know a good bit about Georgia politics, we see it from a left-leaning angle. So we bring you in to see the Republican side of things. And let's start off with the governor's race. We don't necessarily want to start right off with Connie Stokes and all of that, but
I could understand that.
Not, you know, there's not one but two Republican primary candidates in the race. What chance does either Mayor Pennington or John Barge, state school superintendent, have in knocking off Nathan Deal?
Approximately zero is the honest answer, and it's both of them are coming from angles that don't really give them a path to victory. Barge, I guess, will take him first, and again, I'd almost rather you guys take him because I think he made an offer to run as a Democrat and was rebuffed. He's kind of just found himself to be a man on an island or a guy without a home in all of this. He originally ran, you know, he's an accidental state school superintendent. Let's start with that. He was on the ballot when the incumbent, Kathy Cox, resigned her position and decided to move to D.C. instead of run again. The one candidate that, when it looked like there was possibly going to be a primary challenge to Kathy from, we'll call the education establishment or the political establishment, Roger Hines announced the week before qualifying he wasn't going to run. And that left a bit of a scramble to try to figure out who was going to be Georgia State School Superintendent. And ultimately, Barge was kind of the one left on the ballot of a couple of others, I think, that had qualified, you know, that everyone kind of got behind. So he was our school superintendent, but the group that got behind him on the premise that he was going to be for charter schools, said he was for charter schools, suddenly he was against them. He was a guy that administered Common Core, which is something that originated in Georgia. Ultimately was promoted through National Governors Association as an alternative to a federal Department of Education, I don't want to say takeover, but standardization. This has been the practice in Georgia for 10 years, and all of a sudden when it became a political hot potato, he, in one speech that I witnessed at Cobb County GOP breakfast, went from starting a speech trying to defend it and being in favor of it to ending a speech being against it. So that's kind of been his history. He was for charter schools until he was against them. He was for Common Core until he was against it. He's talking about raising $1 million, and, you know, again, he's got $40,000 in the bank if his reports are right. His current disclosure actually says he has negative $2,500 in, but it doesn't look like he carried forward about $38,000 he had on his year-end disclosure. So he's got no money. I don't know where he's going to raise it from because, again, he's kind of thwarted the establishment, if you will, and I'm not really sure, while he's trying to paint himself as the person that would have the teachers' groups behind him, I honestly don't I don't see that either. And so, you know, he kind of has made, you know, an overture that, okay, maybe if he could get the Democrats to come over and vote for him, and again, you guys are going to have a primary, so I don't really see groundswell of a lot of Democrats or folks that don't normally vote in a Republican primary showing up so that this guy can be governor. And so I just don't see what his path is. But at the same point, he was probably already going to be primaried, and there's a couple of candidates, I think. One may have already announced. There's one or two more in the wings that will probably have their candidacy announced very shortly on the Republican side for the state school superintendent. And at least one or two of those was planning on doing it regardless. So, you know, I don't think he really was ultimately – he was going to have a battle just to stay where he was. how he thinks he's going to get to be governor, I have no idea, but I just don't see it happening. Going over to Mayor Pennington, Mayor Pennington's a guy I like. I respect him. We'll jump in some questions on that.
Yeah, I want to jump in on, because, I mean, since we're talking about John Barnes, let's cover him, and you gave him so much there. Let's just ask the question. Who's advising him?
I have no idea. I honestly don't. I don't know that anyone who understands the political landscape of Georgia and his position in it would have advised them to make this decision.
Yeah. I mean, well,
and
okay. Look,
coming out of the gate, he was really clumsy.
When you misspell governor on your website, and you're the guy that's been presiding over the state that, you know, is in the high 40s ranking in education at the bottom, if you will, again, that's something you can blame on a consultant or whoever's designing the website. Sure, fine. But, yeah, as you say, the whole thing just does not show that this was a well-thought-out thing.
It wasn't just that. His first, speech, I can't remember where it was, but, I read it in the AJC or wherever, and he was really clumsy. You know, he didn't know. People were asking him, well, how are you going to pay for things? And he didn't have a good answer. And when they asked him about things that weren't related specifically to education, like economic development, he was all, talking about all these ideas he had, but he had no sort of backup for anything. It was all, and he was going to, he used the tried and true, we're going to have a panel of experts.
Yeah.
How many blue ribbon, committees are we tired of hearing about, right?
Exactly.
I think
I'll need on-the-job training, and I'm going to be in education. But then you have to say, okay, what have you done in 4 years of education? You've been on all sides of every issue and haven't actually implemented anything. What you've done is taken us backwards on the few initiatives that Republicans have done or tried to do. You've essentially dismantled them, but haven't really offered a solution in place.
I probably agree with him a lot on some things, but I just thought he's just sort of stumbled out. He didn't seem to have any, he didn't seem prepared. And then, then the typo on the website was just another indicator of of lack of preparation and lack of sort of understanding what he was doing. And that's never a good way to start.
Yeah. No, I would agree. I frankly don't see the path. I don't see the logic. He's got 6 to 7 months to make his case before the general primary, and I'm sure I'll get plenty of our media as anyone challenging the incumbent governor that's a statewide elected would. But, I think we all have the same observation. None of us get it. And we at least would generally understand one angle of the politics behind it if there was a path. And I don't see it. I don't think y'all see it. And as you said, it just comes across as clumsy, unprepared, and someone that really didn't have anywhere to go. So he just decided to go out in a blaze of glory is kind of the way I read it.
Well, that could be, it could be that he just wants to make a statement before he's, instead of getting voted out, if he were to run again, okay, I'll run for governor and go out in a blaze of glory.
Ask you this then, Charlie, kind of a conclusion on John Barnes before we go on to Mayor Pennington. Let's say there's three paths to be holding office January 2015. He runs for re-election as Republican for state school superintendent. He runs for re-election as a Democrat for state school superintendent, or he runs for governor as a Republican. Which one's his best-case scenario for staying in office? Because the way I'm reading you say this, he is by no means would be a lock to win the primary.
Oh, at this stage, he would not be a lock to win the primary at all. At this stage, I don't see him being in any of those offices because, again, the public tea leaves that have been put out there, and you guys know the Democratic Party establishment much better than I do, but it does not appear he's welcome to run as a Democrat, and even if he was, I think he runs the same problem in the general election. I don't know that he really carries Republican votes over because he's not well known as a champion of the Republican/conservative ideas of the things that Republicans have tried to do in education. So I don't think he brings a crossover vote with him if he comes over to your party. If he were to remain elected, his best chance, just because he is an incumbent, is to run again as a Republican state school superintendent candidate. But as public as he's been with saying he wasn't going to do that, he's already drawn the primary challenge. And it's not just the political establishment that would probably be looking at the challenge, you know, at backing anyone else. It's, frankly, the business community and the others that know that Georgia needs a clear and concise path and, frankly, a leadership team to make the changes that need to be made to education in this state. And right now, you've got a guy that has just been such a total wild card that no one's really ready to line up behind him for another term. You need someone that kind of can articulate what they're going to do and do it, not a guy that changes his mind in front of one hostile crowd in one speech at a breakfast meeting. And so, I think he's done himself in, frankly. That's probably just the most succinct way of putting it.
Well, and I would tell you, I would, I guess, have a philosophical issue that the state school superintendent needs to be the charter school promoter, the voucher promoter, because to me that'd be like your agriculture chief, being in front of in favor of processed foods. I mean, their job's to improve public education in Georgia. So if they're busy trying to figure out alternative paths to education besides public education, they're actually working against what they're responsible for. So I think in that vein, you know, John Barge has actually worked on what he's supposed to work on.
On the concept that charter schools are public schools. They're schools that are designed to be run differently with different standards and, frankly, with different inputs, because a charter school can require things like parental involvement and can focus on programs that are an alternative to the ubiquitous rubber stamp cookie cutter, everyone fits a square peg, square hole public schools. And given that we bounced around the bottom with the model we have of public schools for so long, again, when you look at where the support came from for the charter school amendment, some of the biggest areas of support came from some of the areas with the worst schools, but again, not Republican constituencies. Your opposition actually came from a lot of suburban Atlanta where the public schools are great. Your support for that measure came from Clayton County, DeKalb County, South Fulton County, where the schools, you know, you've had City of Atlanta, you know, all of those have been mentioned with accreditation problems and various other problems. And there are parents that aren't part of the political establishment, but they knew when they went to vote, they were looking at an alternative for something. And charter schools are money that stay within the public system. You might have a different way of administering it, but it's, you know, there's a huge difference between charter schools and vouchers. And, charter schools fit within the realm of what a public school model can be. And that is a vision that Republicans, for the most part, with the exception of our accidental school superintendent, have lined up behind. And again, it's not just Republicans that are doing that. I mean, President Obama's own words were used in the commercials that were run on a lot of Atlanta radio play during the run-up to that charter school amendment that are credited with a large part of the turnout and the passage for it. And so it's not just a Republican idea, but it is a real alternative to a break from the status quo or the solution we hear so often that we're just supposed to throw more money at the problem, yet no one can ever quantify how much money is enough or what that money is really going to do. It's just supposedly going to make it better. And we've tried throwing money at the problem forever, and Republicans are trying to articulate it's how you spend the money, it's how you bring the parents back in to get them involved in the schools. You know, there have to be other solutions that actually focus on not the input, but the output. What are we getting out of these schools? And that's the message that has to be conveyed. And frankly, for, again, those that would be in a Republican primary, they haven't seen that out of Barge. And so,
well, I think a lot of teachers in Georgia since 2002, they wouldn't say that we're throwing the money at the problem. So much has been slashed, not cut, but slashed since about 2002. Out of Georgia education, I mean, I've been in it every day.
Well, but I'm also going back to when we ramped up under, starting with Zell Miller, where we started the very large increases in teacher pay, where we got to the highest in real dollar terms in the Southeast, and we were the first or second in the nation in terms of pay per cost of living. and yet our scores and our ranking didn't move at all. So we've seen putting money at the problem versus the results, and it didn't move the needle. So I'm not saying necessarily that's an excuse to cut, but it is saying that just throwing money at the problem isn't enough. We've got to focus on what the outcomes is and how we get there.
Well, and the needle, I don't think you'd say, has moved since we hadn't gotten raises either, but I'm talking about actually spending in the classroom has been cut more than anything. I'm not talking about the lack of raises since 2002. I'm talking about just the money in the classroom has just significantly changed some of the different offerings. I mean, for instance, when I came into education in the 90s, elementary schools were start having computer classes more with teachers. They were having foreign language. I can't tell you the last time I've heard of an elementary school offering foreign language in any of the counties near where I am. And, I mean, we know in America, throughout our country, we do a terrible job compared to other nations with foreign language. Well, if you don't have the money to pay those teachers, then you're just not going to get good because you're not teaching it. And that's not a Georgia versus Arkansas versus Arizona issue. That's just an American education issue, which we were actually doing a little something in Georgia during Zell Miller's time, and it may have extended some into Barnes' time, but it was more with Miller. Well, let's not ignore Mayor Pennington. He got in this thing first. Now, I don't fully understand the workings of Dalton City elections, but I have a feeling win, lose, or draw, he gets to be the mayor of Dalton the day after the primary, right?
I don't think that's the case, actually. I'm not sure when their elections are and whether or not his seat would be up this time and he just moved from it. But municipal elections in Georgia are off year from the others. So either his term expires a year after the governor's race, or it expires this year before he would qualify. Regardless of that, Georgia has a resign-to-run law that if your term doesn't end concurrent with when one expires and the other. So I don't believe he's going to still be Dalton mayor, but I haven't honestly looked to see when the current term begins and ends. But no, I think to answer your question, no, he's not safe as mayor while he runs for governor. At the time he qualifies, I believe he has to choose either qualify to officially qualify to run, which I think is going to be in March at this point based on the new primary date, or and resign or not qualify. But, you know, he says he's in, so he appears to be running what I would call a serious campaign from the standpoint of, you know, he's treating it like a campaign. And, you know, I don't see any sign that this is something that he's going to try to pull back from. And I frankly, while I know of him and know what he's done as mayor, and from, again, when you talk about the two candidates and who has a Republican record, Mayor Pennington has a Republican record. He's one of the ones that's cut taxes when he had the opportunity to not do that, balanced his budgets, even when the state did its manufacturing tax or got rid of the tax on electricity that said the local municipalities could put their portion of the tax back on, because some of the areas, especially up there around where the carpet mills are, were getting a large part of the revenue from electricity sold to those mills. But Dalton, I think, was one of the few that decided not to put the local portion back on. And so, again, he's got a record of walking the walk, not just talking the talk. And so he's the kind of guy that you'd like to see ultimately move up at some point into something. But his rationale for wanting to do this is about economic development and job creation. And the folks that tend to really want to push that, would back a campaign around that, would give credence that the status quo needs to change. Generally, your Chamber of Commerce type groups, and Sam Williams of the Metro Chamber has very specifically endorsed personally and on behalf of his organization the reelection of both Mayor Kasim Reed and Governor Deal. And the business community in general seems to be okay with the current setup. And so going back to where's your political strategy, while Mayor Pennington's been a great mayor, has an excellent record for running the city of Dalton, and has done it in a way that, you know, certainly would, you know, lead him to have credibility as a Republican candidate, the appetite to change based on his platform among those that would be most affected by what he says needs to be done different just doesn't seem to be there. So, again, I just don't see the path that he is trying to lay out that gets him to be elected. I don't see the Republican primary voter saying, well, this has to be done significantly differently, that we go from an incumbent who we know fairly well how things are going to work to someone that is saying we should do things different, but we don't really know if we can even do it, if we should do it. And those that are involved in economic development seem to be ready to rally behind the governor.
Okay. Well, Tim, let me let you jump in here with any questions about the governor's race, and we honestly probably hadn't even covered one of the most important factors, and that's the man sitting in the governor's mansion right now.
Yeah. Let me back up for just a moment to John Barge, because we have talked on here, and it's been rumored, that he possibly jumped in the race because he just simply personally does not like Nathan Deal. Have you heard that, Charlie, and is there anything to it?
I would not characterize it that way in the things that I've heard. I would say that their working relationship has been strained since the charter school amendment, because he did originally, before he got the blessing of, again, I'd have to go back and look, but I'm fairly well, if I remember right, the Deal team basically did kind of help pick him as part of the nominee, but definitely what we'll call the establishment kind of vetted him as the best candidate that was on the ballot as a Republican to get behind. And part of that process of, as the other folks that would have been on the ballot with him were asking those questions, involved the charter school amendments, and when he ultimately chose not to support that amendment, that created some friction, because it seemed very clear that folks were under the impression that that was something he was going to support. So there's been a bit of a strained relationship since then, and frankly, a little bit of difficulty dealing with trying to get the goals of the Department of Education in line with the rest of those running the state, which pretty much is the governor. Because, the governor, one of the problems, and it goes back to, again, whether that should be an elected or appointed position, is when you get a bad report on education or anything else, as we all know, civics, an understanding of civics and how things work in this country, and especially down at the state and local levels, is almost broken. So people pick up the phone and they call and yell at whoever they want to yell at, and that's usually going to be their state rep or state senator, or if they really feel they have the initiative, they'll pick up the phone, call the governor's office, and yell at him. Many people don't even know who the state school superintendent is, much less, what that department controls or doesn't control. And so you already have legislators that are tired of getting yelled at for rankings that are going down. And, again, the budget issues, as we addressed earlier, we had cut across the board, and classrooms and teachers have definitely felt that. Since the meltdown in 2008, 5 years ago now. And so when you look at things like that, there's a lot of people that are sharing that anger. And if the folks don't work on trying to solve those problems as a team, then you get to the point of, again, if one person's standing out and bucking the trend of the solutions coming out from the rest, then you're going to have a little bit of friction. And so I think it's safe to say that he may have been viewed by the majority of the rest that would be described as part of that team as not being a team player.
Mm-hmm. Now, to your knowledge, are there any high-profile Republicans, either elected or activists in this state, who are not supporting Governor Deal?
Activists, yes. But again, when you start defining what an activist is, do they have a block behind them that, I'll just say it, that matters? I'm certainly not aware of any elected. Other than clearly Barge, who's, a statewide elected. Short answer, no. At this point, I just don't see the appetite, even the folks that, shall we say, within the activist groups that are really vocal about being anti-incumbency, they tend to be looking much more at Washington as the folks they want changed than there's a few folks that just, we've been around politics long enough, we've always known a certain segment is throw the bums out and is against any incumbent. The folks that most of that ire, though, again, still really is aimed at the Washington candidates, not so much at the statewides and, frankly, at the governor. I just don't really see I don't see the catalyst for a groundswell if there was, say, a better candidate than the two that have offered themselves up. At mm-hmm. this stage, it's just not there. And now, again, we've still got I think we're a little more than 6 months away from qualifying, I guess. And so, there's time. Things could happen, but in general, no. The seeds are not there to be watered at this time that I really see the governor having a huge trouble. You know, these two guys clearly can get press anytime you've got someone challenging someone that's as powerful as a sitting governor and with the power that is concentrated in Georgia under the governor's control. Anyone that's challenging them publicly is going to get media, and you'll see news reports. When it comes time to vote, I just don't really see institutional and organizational appetite for change there.
Well, you know, I not to beat a dead horse, but I guess I am going to do so. I want to go back to something. I recall nearly 40 years ago, I was sitting in my brother's house, and we were talking with a fellow who of David's acquaintance, a fellow by the name of Buddy Childers, who was running for the state house for the first time, and he was walking the district. That's what he had to do. And I asked him, being the naive 19-year-old that I was, why are you running, buddy? And he looked at me and said, well, I'm running to win. So that being, you know, the prime reason to run, I just don't see the angle of these two guys. Do you?
Short answer is no. No, when you ask it, how are you going to win? And any time, you know, when I started politics, I think you could always argue that even, you know, those of us that have been in it for 20 years or longer still don't know what we're doing or naive at times. But mm-hmm. I have gotten much better of when someone tells me they're going to run, specifically when they're asking for my support or advice. That really is one of the first questions I ask them. How are you going to win? What's your plan? Because if they're, as you said, there used to be a time where you could go door to door, and in smaller districts, and you know, and even in a House district, you might be able to do that. A state Senate district, when someone says they're going to go door to door, if they're not known, and that's really their, if they don't have an army of grassroots behind them to help them do that, and they would be able to specifically name those people and say they've got commitments, and they've got commitments for people they're going to write checks, then I know that they're the ones that are being naive at that point. And I just frankly, out of these guys that we're saying, I don't see a path that even they think they have to win. And it's quizzical, but it's a free country, and they're entitled to do what they want to do. And, you know, we'll see how it works out and who's the naive one in about, you know, by next July or next May, I guess.
Yeah.
I just want to pipe in here for a second and say that sometimes people run, like, I mean, I think that to run without the goal of winning is kind of, you know, stupid. It's a waste of effort. It's a waste of time, and it's a waste of, you know, donors' money.
Well, it's also a waste of the political capital of those you're asking to put their name on the line and support.
Right.
And that's
however,
the point that, frankly, I've tried to make to at least one of these two candidates in preliminary discussions running up is, if you don't have a plan to win, but you're asking other people to put their name on the line to go down with your sinking ship, you're not just ruining your political capital. You're hurting other people's political capital that you're not going to be able to get back.
Amen.
In an effort to tilt a windmill just to make a statement. And,
well, and that's
that
what I was
going to
say. Sometimes
about personal
people
ego and
just
not
want
about the bigger picture.
Sometimes people just want to be able to bring up whether it's, you know, Dennis Kucinich running for president because he wants a discussion about whatever the issues are that are important to him. I think we all knew when someone like David Kucinich or or Al Sharpton, when they were running, we knew that that was the reason. Like, it was pretty clear that they understood they weren't going to win. But
well, I mean,
again,
you can make the same correlation to what how we currently choose presidential candidates, because you know every year that there are two or three of them that are going on a book tour, or every cycle, I should say. And sometimes those going on a book tour accidentally find themselves front runner and then get vetted, and the white hot spotlight comes on them, and we learn
yep.
things that they didn't want anyone to ever know, because all they really
yep.
wanted was a cable news contributor, you know, bump up, or that they wanted to sell, you know, a bunch of books and be able to go on speaking tour. So there,
right,
there
but,
are a lot of reasons
but
people
we usually
do this.
Can figure that
level,
out.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I'm saying. At the state level, it becomes much more when people are insisting that they can win and that there's a path there, but they can't articulate it beyond, well, things need to change, or, you know, there's a certain level of naivety and simplicity that becomes dangerous because of what happens to the people that, you know, okay, maybe you do have a valid point, but if this is the only way that you can make that point, you're number one going to diminish the point, because when the election returns come in, the people, you can honestly say people voted against your ideas. And then secondly, those that were willing to make the point with you are marginalized, because forever in the next several campaign cycles, oh, you're one of those people that supported that guy that got 10% of the vote. So why should we listen to you this time when you're bringing us another new candidate that says he has great ideas? I mean, that's how politics works.
Right.
So when someone decides to take a step up at this level of stage and poke the bear that they're about to try to poke, if they don't have a plan for victory that passes the smell test of other people that would need to be required to put a coalition together to take out an incumbent, then they're tilting a windmill, and frankly, they should be left to do it by themselves.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go, David.
Well, I'm here. I'm just waiting, getting y'all some time for some questions since I kind of monopolized it early. Let's go ahead and move over to this U.S. Senate race, which that's where all the candidates are. And, of course,
see the clown car.
We need
a sound effect for a clown car.
Well, and honestly, I mean, if you look at it, we now have three candidates on the Democratic side, too, so... It's really getting full in the sense of fairness. But I honestly went to Politics One to make sure I had all the candidates listed down, and it is quite a list of candidates that are officially running. There's some names on this list that I've never heard considering it that are listed too, but we're just going to look at the bold candidates, if you will, that are actually in the race. Let's go ahead and look at the Republican side first and foremost, since you've probably been up close and personal with a lot more of these folks than Tim Cather and I have. I mean, there's one or two of them that I wouldn't know if I ran to them on the street, because they hadn't served in Congress. They hadn't been Secretary of State. Who would you say right now is the front runner in this race?
I can throw one quick thing, and you have four Democrats that have announced and filed with the FEC at this point, and no one knows that either, because I'm forgetting, but there's a guy by the name of John F. Coyne, who's the one I'm guessing you're probably not having, and I had to just Google him real quick. Just so we know about Dr. Rad, because he's putting stuff out. Steve Miles has announced. Of course, Michelle Nunn is the only one any from the party apparatus will acknowledge is actually running.
And Todd,
not that from the party apparatus, but I will freely recognize Dr. Rad.
Okay. So,
yeah, and Todd Robinson.
Catherine probably has the same issue with Blog for Democracy, because again, if you look at the Georgia 11 race, I think I've gotten press releases from three other people, maybe four, other than the ones that we generally refer to as the candidates that are running. I just really have gotten to the point, I don't believe just because someone decides to write on the thing that they're running, and there's no evidence of a campaign, I've seen them at no events, that they're a candidate. And so, I mean, that becomes a journalistic, where do you draw the line of who's a candidate and who's not? Because, again, in the U.S. Senate race, you've got Minister Derek Grayson, who I think has raised $3,000 or $4,000 total. I mean, he's going around to the events, and he's doing it, and he's going to be on the ballot. And one of the regular readers of my column from down in the southern end of the state emails me regularly about him and tells me he's the one that's going to win. So you know, yeah, we count him as a candidate, but is he a candidate? I mean, does anyone think he's really got a snowball's chance of winning? Absolutely not. So, you know, how to even say who is a candidate and who's not becomes a judgment call at some point. Up until the once people have qualified, then clearly we have candidates. But up until that point, anyone can say, they can even file with the FTC. It's not that big of a deal if you're not raising money, just to drop, you know, that and the paperwork that comes after it. But at any rate, point being is that, yes, there's at least seven that have announced in the Republican side. There's probably, or I won't say probably, but very possibly we'll have an eighth within the next month. And so with that, that's the lead-in. Now, what was the exact question you just asked me about the race? Do you want me to break them down by person?
Yeah. Before I ask it, I want to make a point on something that's changed in the past decade that makes you more of a candidate is, honestly, because of the Internet. The Internet's a great equalizer. If you take $1,000, $2,000, and you throw up a decent-looking website, you can become more of a contender than you really are, because you can't play in direct mail, you can't play on TV, but you can throw up a website like Derek Grayson and Eugene Yu have that look credible, and then you begin to sneak closer to that tier in some people's eyes that are just looking on the Internet. So that's another thing that kind of, I think, can fool us at times. But my question was, who's the front runner on this thing?
There's not one. Just to be blunt, because I actually did break it down into a column 2 or 3 weeks ago, I still don't think that folks have really picked up on how much the federal judge moving the election to give a 9-week runoff changes the game. Because a 9-week runoff, those of us that have run campaigns have always known that a runoff really is a separate standalone campaign, and you have to do everything in that 3-week campaign that you had to do for the maybe 2 years that you ran the other campaign. And if you treat it like a separate campaign and have a battle plan for it, understanding that it's not just a continuation of what you've been doing, you can have a successful second campaign's runoff. Well, now in a 9-week campaign, the donors are starting to understand that. So first of all, I'm already hearing anecdotally that checkbooks are closing, that people are realizing that in a 7- or 8-person race where you have at least 4 shall we say, top-tier candidates, and then 1 or 2 more that could break into that group, given the time, if they're willing to put the money behind it to really generate name ID for themselves and propel a message, you've got to figure out which 2 are even going to be in the runoff and then have another 9-week race. That's a totally different race, because how anyone is paired against another one determines who's ultimately going to get the checks when the checkbooks open up. Because once it's a head-to-head, the people that do write checks for these campaigns, it's a lot easier to pick a winner when you have a 50% chance than it is when you're trying to pick 1 out of 7 or 1 out of 8, even if you know it's 1 out of 4 of those 7. You still don't know when you have, again, a Eugene Yu that could get in, and if he can self-fund at the level he's talking about. Amazingly, he gives an excellent stump speech, too. And so will he be in the runoff? Absolutely not. But could he get up to 3 to 5%? Possibly. And who does then that take 2% away from, which could be, again, if you look back at how the 2010 governor's race was on the GOP side, I think the difference between first and third was not huge. And I believe Eric Johnson, if I'm remembering right, and could be pulling the wrong numbers, I think he lost the runoff or missed the runoff by 1,500 votes or something like that. So when you have a 7-person race, while it's easy to dismiss those folks that are at the bottom tier, ultimately, every vote they get is one that comes away from someone else. And if you've got folks that are all polling in the high teens right now, all the money they have or don't have is going to be spent in the last 60 days before that vote. And that moves things. Go back and look at the 2010 governor's race where John Oxendine went from first to fourth in that get-out-the-vote time period. You can have the same thing happen in the U.S. Senate race. You can have the same thing happen in the congressional races where you have 4 to 6 or 7 people running in each district. And so really, we don't know who the front runner is going to be, because until we really know who's head to head, you know, it'll be a lot easier for those of us that are pundits and for those that are trying to write checks or whatever to figure out. When you see what the head-to-head matchup is, you can figure out who's going to get which constituency and who's run the smarter campaign thus far and has positioned themselves for a runoff race. But, you know, right now when you have seven people races, you're having to take positions on everything. And, you know, there's folks that are having to figure out, okay, if I take this position now, is that going to be the issue when I'm in the runoff, depending on who I'm against in that runoff, and is it still going to play then? And then, of course, can I get back towards a middle of the road center right to make sure I'm still okay for a general election? And that's kind of what's going on right now, but, you know, I'm not willing to pick a front runner.
Okay, I'm going to give you an easy question before I pass this thing to Tim and Catherine. Who's the front runner in the Democratic primary?
I believe we will all agree that Dr. Rad is going to take. No, of course, Michelle Nunn is going to win that primary. I just can't imagine how that doesn't happen. But you know, strange things happen. But I don't expect y'all to go that strange this time.
I was just wanting to let you have a chance at a concise answer on that side, because obviously the Republican side is far more interesting. Well, Tim, give some more questions on this U.S. Senate primary, and then we'll go to Catherine, and then we'll probably be about 8 o'clock.
Okay, Charlie, look, I've been looking at this thing. I see no way anybody on the GOP side can break the 40% barrier on primary night, possibly not even 35%. Am I right?
Oh, I think you're very right. That's why I say it's so difficult to figure out who's going to be the winner, because I can't even figure out, you know, who's going to be above, you know, 20% at this point. And it's possible that, again, you could have someone get 22-23%, someone else get 20, and those are the folks going in the runoff in a field that's crowded. And therein lies the problem. A 2-3% move late in the race could easily, much like it happened in the 2010 governor's primary, move somebody from first to fourth or fourth to first. And both of those happened, because Nathan Deal, if I remember right, was running fourth in the polls until about 6 weeks out, and John Oxenheim was running first.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have that same dynamic all over again. These folks, every poll you see, they're always in different order because they're moving within the margin of error, and people really haven't decided who they even want to vote for yet, for the most part. And so, you know, each comes with their strength. The one thing I will say is I think Paul Brown is at his high water mark. So his people, he has the most dedicated supporters, but I don't see that he's got the ability to add to what he has. But he could very well be one of the ones in the runoff. I just don't see how he adds to that once he gets in it. His supporters are dedicated, but I don't see that he's going to get more than what he currently has. And so the question is, if anyone can chip away at him and take him out of the runoff, I think he's got room to go down a little bit, but not a lot again, because, like I say, those that want to vote for him really, really want to vote for him. So he's probably the one that is the most fixed where he is. The question becomes is can two other people get secure enough past him that he's not a factor in the runoff? And honestly, I think more than likely someone in the runoff with him is the one that ultimately comes out the winner if he's in the runoff. Again, I think Karen Handel is very well positioned for a variety of reasons, having run statewide before. I think she's got a better than average shot. You look at Phil Gingrey, that's represented most of Georgia's media markets via redistricting all the way down to Macon, Columbus, Chattanooga, certainly Metro Atlanta. He's well known and has been around a while and does appeal to both, you know, the establishment Republicans looking at his congressional record, but also some that would look at Paul Brown. So he kind of runs the gamut there. And then Kingston's got a very solid record and is doing very well with fundraising. His challenge is getting known to the people that live north of I-20 that really just don't know who he is. And it's very expensive to do that because those are the media markets where it costs money, but he's going to have the most money. And so, again, you've got the scenario where any two of those four could be together, just depending on how they execute their 60-day get-out-the-vote plan as we get closer to.
All right. Thank you, sir. Catherine?
But that could also... end up, if the four of them even out, then some, who we might think of as an also-ran could pull up to the front just because the other ones are, evening the score out. So
what you look at is one of those also-rans jumping up from, again, 2% to 5%. taking 3% away from four people that are bunched at 20% each makes a huge difference.
Right,
and so
exactly.
That's really what I see. I see those guys playing spoiler that, you know, if someone was polling at 20 but comes in at 17 because one of the also-rans took 3% of their vote, that could very well be what makes a huge difference.
Well, I think it's going to be an interesting few months going forward. But I think there's going to be some interest on the Democratic side. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that it's Michelle Nunes to lose, but it could be interesting just because of the various characters that are playing.
Always.
Yeah,
David,
well,
it's 8:00.
Charlie, I know it just flew by. Charlie, before we let you go, anything going on Peach Pundit or any of your newspaper columns you want folks to know about?
Oh, we've been eating a lot of barbecue lately. We are at least trying to get out, and we've been to 5 congressional districts thus far, including sat down with John Barrow last month, and actually I guess it was month before last. So we are working both sides of the aisle because we, you know, when there's food involved, we'll eat with anybody. And so we're looking forward to more Republicans and more Democrats. Just visited with Doug Collins up in Georgia 9 in Danielsville yesterday, and I highly recommend Zeb's Barbecue, great stew. And so yeah, we're getting out and trying to meet the people and talking to our congressmen in the process, and we're having a lot of fun with that.
All right. Well, good again to talk to you, Charlie, and bringing that right side of the aisle knowledge on Georgia politics.
Well, enjoyed it. You guys
thanks,
have
Charlie.
A great Sunday evening, and we'll talk again soon.
Okay.
Thank you so much, goodness. Charlie.
Thanks, everybody.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
We are the